to the show. This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And joining us this week is big name guest.
Oh, do I say my name? John Semley.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I got thrown off by big name. I started blushing. Yeah, I'm a freelance writer, and I review movies and tweet about movies and teach movies sometimes. And I'm an admirer of Twin Peaks: The Return. And in fact, sort of eating my own words, because I wrote a longer piece for Salon about how nobody should be ever talking about it or theorizing about it, and just enjoying it. But here we are.
Yeah. Sorry to make you break your promise, but thank you for joining us. I mean, you've said you just stated you're an admirer of the show, but do you have any other kind of general thoughts on The Return so far? Or
yeah, sure. I mean, well, I'll say this. I mean, I did not let myself get hyped up for this show because I was in the back of my mind worried that it would be disappointing. But then sort of signed up for Crave TV to get the episodes on Sunday night, which is a thing I've never bothered to do throughout the entire golden age of television. You know, I go out of my way to watch it when it airs. But I think it's terrific, and I think it exceeds any and all of my expectations. I think it's really the only worthy cable television program since The Sopranos. Everything else is just sort of a fun trifle. And I don't know, I've never watched something in real time that has been so able to upset my expectations, I mean, not upset me, although it does upset and disturb me at times. And I guess it's sort of a cliche of Lynch or something like that, but it's a thing where you truly never know where it's going. And I think that feeling is kind of curdling or hardening into a form of anxiety as the show reaches what is ostensibly its endgame, which is maybe something I'd be interested to talk about. I mean, we have all these sort of plot lines still being introduced or sort of old characters coming back, and one wonders what's going to become of them in the intervening 5 hours. But I suppose 5 hours is still quite a long stretch.
This is maybe the starting point for us tonight. I think the thing this episode at least crystallized for me, this is something I brought up in our previous episode, is the fact that a lot of the scenes are not being presented in a linear fashion. I think in particular the Twin Peaks scenes, the examples being, of course, Bobby referencing an event from episode 9, clearly Shelley and Becky referencing something, a scene that I think takes place before episode 11 and whatnot. So, I mean, I think people are now going to even as we're reaching the end, are going to go into, like, kind of theorizing overdrive in terms of trying to pick apart why scenes are put in the place they are. I mean, I don't know if you, we've brought this up in almost every episode, John, but I don't know if you kind of dive into the world of Reddit. I guess you don't, since you don't enjoy the theorizing, but...
I mean, I have in my darkest, moodiest moments. But yeah, I mean, there is sort of that idea that the timelines as we see them, the Vegas plot line and the South Dakota plot line and the Twin Peaks plot line, are not in sync. And that's sort of been made apparent in a few different cases. You know, I know people even try to mark like when the days pass in terms of, is it day, is it night? But I assume they're all going to converge in one place. Although it's looking more and more to me like it makes more sense for them to converge in Las Vegas in over Twin Peaks. But then again, they're dispatching Hawk and Bobby and Robert Forster's new sheriff into the woods for some sort of dramatic cosmic seeming event. So perhaps it'll all converge there.
Nevada and Washington aren't that far.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, and they're all sort of in that region where, you know, we see Evil Coop. Where is he, in Utah or something? Where's the farm located?
Montana, in the last episode. West Montana, right, as they specify.
Yeah. I mean, this is the stuff that gets me feeling loopy, you know, when they're, like, looking up the actual coordinates for Matthew Lillard's website and stuff like that. I assume all will be revealed. You know, what's the description from episode 2? You know, the stars align and time reveals itself to itself. Mm-hmm. So I presume we're going to get there. It's just like, you know, you have stuff like, and the thing that in the past couple of episodes has had my hairs on the back of my neck up a bit is when the show started, there was a lot of this commentary that I was really sort of bristling at about how the show is a sort of self-reflexive commentary on watching TV itself or on the nostalgia for Twin Peaks itself, which I think is just such like hokey bullshit. I can't stand that like type of thinking about stuff where it's like, well, really, it's all about the process of our consuming it. Like, it's modestly clever if you're 13 or something and smoked weed for the second time, but I just like always held Lynch to a bit of a higher standard. But now I find myself where it's like, oh my God, like maybe it is about these things, you know? For example, introducing Big Ed, having him sitting there eating soup for the end credits, which was great and a sort of weird, poignant moment, but it almost feels like a sort of answer to people back with Fire Walk With Me, or like, where's Big Ed? Where's Nadine? And it's like, well, they're not really doing anything. You know, Big Ed's sitting in the garage eating soup. He's like not necessarily instrumental to the thrust of a larger plot. Or even these scenes with Audrey and her new husband, where they're just sort of mentioning off-screen characters that you've never seen, just kind of frustrating a viewer's attempt to keep everything straight. And, you know, I could have this totally wrong, but those are the things that are starting to frustrate me because, like, I don't need Twin Peaks to be a commentary on itself, you know? And for a while, it didn't seem like it was going in that direction. And now that it's sort of throwing in these kind of signifiers that point at that, you know, like I say, I'm still enjoying it every week, but I'm kind of grumbling a bit more.
Yeah, I guess I haven't read those quieter moments as a commentary on it. For me, it's more just a certain kind of... it's the freedom that Lynch has been allotted by Showtime, and it's him taking advantage of that freedom. What's funny, though, John, is that what you say does make me think of something relating to the production of the show and how we maybe know more about it than we should, which is, of course, the fact that Lynch had pulled away from this a couple of years ago because it seemed he wasn't going to get the resources he wanted. And there was sort of this question of, you know, how is this going to expand from a supposed 9 hours to apparently now 18 hours? And then you actually see it in action, and it becomes a lot clearer, doesn't it? The end credit sequence, it's not just that the end credit sequence is Big Ed sitting there, silent, eating soup, drinking coffee, but that the sequence before it is his nephew performing his classic song, Just You and I, which 25 years later does not sound different in any way whatsoever, amazingly. His voice is exactly the same, and the guitar playing is precisely the same. To me, yeah, I guess I'm enjoying it still consistently, I think in part because there is the sense that we're coming to the end of it, and there's only going to be so much of this, particularly before the plot begins to really ramp up, which I've been feeling a lot lately. I mean, the episode opens with a very kind of comical, irreverent moment that nevertheless relates directly to the central thread. And there's kind of a propulsion, there's this increased propulsion to it that I think was really not present in the first episodes. And for me, watching that unfold has been this, just been this continual pleasure.
Yeah, I will say, I think in one of the last episodes, I think it was you, Nick, mentioned that, you know, sometimes the show does sort of comment on its own nostalgia in a way, or the nostalgia for it. And there was one moment of that that I really loved. Like, it's not only Cooper getting the coffee and the pie or whatever, but it was the scene with Norma and her daughter, played by Amanda Seyfried, where in the past episode where she's like, well, come down, I'll give you some coffee and some pie. And you almost expect it to totally switch, like, you know, fuck you, Mom, like, pie is not going to solve anything. But then it's like, oh no, pie actually does solve everything in the show. She cannot resist the lure of her mother's unprofitable pies. which, you know, again, like, in my mind when that was playing out, I was like, well, I kind of hope this goes the other way and shows that, like, these things don't matter. But it was ultimately much nicer to be like, yes, the pie at the double R still has this sort of, like, mystic pull that can't quite be explained.
I mean, if we want to talk about nostalgia and characters doing what we want them to or not to, it's interesting. I think James has smiled in all of his screen time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer, to go against the line from the earlier episode, you know, James has always sucked. An interesting thing I read about James is he sued the makers of the pharmaceutical acne medicine Accutane because he thought it gave him a bowel disorder. He had to get like his whole So he's had a quiet career, and he tried to sue them basically because he's like, this ruined my career. My career never got off the ground. So as you're saying, Nick, when you do go into the production details, it's like, oh, what's James been up to? Or what James Marshall, right? Yeah. And you dig into it, it's like, oh, he was getting his colon extracted. But yeah, I mean, I thought that was kind of funny. I have a very ambivalent relationship with the Roadhouse scenes. I don't know if you guys have talked about this much before, but like, there's things I certainly appreciate them about them. I appreciate the fact that, you know, it gives Lynch and Frost an opportunity to resolve an episode in a sort of false way that doesn't involve the cliches of premium TV, like cliffhangers or stuff like that. I also just think a lot of the bands on it are kind of like eye-rolly, you know, and it's like, it's obviously a wet dream for them to essentially nip their entire musical aesthetic from Twin Peaks and then appear on the show.
You're just upset there isn't Pantera, isn't it, John?
I don't like that stuff, but it was funny seeing James there, like, you know, performing the song from 25 years earlier. It does not sound different at all. And like, again, one wonders how it took him 25 years to make it to the stage.
Unless he's been performing it just consistently for 25 years, which is much more horrifying to think about.
One That's true. Wonder. He did get the sort of dedicated intro, just like the Nine Inch Nails did. You know, like he was thrown to in a way that a lot of the other acts aren't. But anyways, all of which is to say, if James doesn't figure into the plot anymore beyond that, I would be totally okay with that being the case.
In terms of talking about the show being edited, I think there's a bit of a running theme even throughout this episode of like capitalism, and thinking of that, I actually expected it to cut to Eddie Vedder performing at the Roadhouse. The episode was about capitalism, but I guess not.
Right. He is listed, right? He is supposed to appear at some point?
Yeah. Every time they cut to that exterior, I dread it being Eddie Vedder on stage.
Well, I got my Eddie Vedder aesthetics dose watching the middling to bad Wet Hot American Summer 10 years later on Netflix this weekend. In which Paul Rudd pretty much looked exactly like Eddie Vedder. But yeah, I don't know. Like, what else happened this episode that was exciting? I mean, there was obviously the stuff with Evil Coop where you find yourself almost rooting for Evil Coop because he becomes this sort of, you know, stock action movie, stiff upper lip badass or something. That was an insanely entertaining. And, you know, the boss of that gang getting his face caved in with a punch was, you know, one of those many scenes in this show where I'm kind of like jumping up and screaming at the TV, or at least exclaiming, oh my God. And I feel like a lot of stuff was moved along there, but I mean, that scene obviously poses a lot of questions. I mean, the whereabouts of Philip Jeffries, if Diane is working with Philip Jeffries, what's going to happen with the ring? I mean, like I say, there's as much stuff being introduced as there were in the first couple episodes. And I don't worry that it's going to resolve, but again, it's like that phrase with novels, right? The telltale compression of pages, where you see something sort of winnowing towards its end and it sort of stirs a kind of anxiety in you. But maybe the anxiety is just like melancholy that it will be over soon.
Well, I was going to say that if you look at both the original series and Fire Walk With Me, there is a similar narrative quality to them, not just the series as a whole, but the conclusion of the first season, the conclusion of the second season, kind of the last scenes of the film. And I would say in all those cases, there isn't really a sort of cut and dry pat conclusion to any of it, is there? Right. There are a lot of things that are put in place and then they kind of keep moving after the credits have rolled. And I guess for me, it's probably, there are certain things I think it's easier to guess that, you know, it's easier to guess whether or not they will be rounded up. I think the stuff involving the FBI, the stuff involving Dougie/Cooper and Evil Cooper, you get the sense that those are heading towards a conclusion. And especially the stuff with, you know, going into the woods with the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. But a lot of the side material, the Roadhouse stuff, the stuff with maybe the more cosmic aspects with the ring. I mean, perhaps we'll see that come into play, but as to how it actually comes into play, I don't know. It feels, I don't want to hazard a guess just yet, but I guess what I would say is that the sense I'm getting is that if it does in fact have a piece in the final narrative, it's going to be more almost incidental than oh yes, this thing means that this thing was going to happen all along. Right. I mean, what the hell is going on with Audrey lately? Because we have another scene with her, and I'm now seeing people are perpetuating this theory that she's actually in a coma, and that this is like some her sort of purgatory or something, which seems entirely possible, I guess. But there's kind of this weird sense with those scenes that they exist almost entirely out of time. There's allusions to things that have happened, because it's the whole thing about someone stealing a truck, and of course you think about her supposed son having a truck. But who are the names? What are the names that are being rattled off?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Why have they moved from the study to the living room?
And I mean, why is Charlie's demeanor entirely different? He's gone from cuck to mansplainer.
Not everyone is a goddamn cuck, Ethan.
Have you been listening to the shows, John?
I have. I mean, there's got to be a running cuck count for this show. But I haven't heard that theory about her being in a coma, Nick, but I certainly understand what you mean. I mean, even the sort of weird shot, reverse shot editing that you see in those conversation scenes are something you don't necessarily see a lot or doesn't seem as obvious. I mean, I remember even when it opened up to a two shot in the last episode, I was sort of wondering if they were even in the same room when they were making the scene or something. But yeah, I mean, I do sort of wonder about that. I mean, to talk about the larger issues, I guess, of entering Endgame and, you know, resolution and whatnot, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, even if you think of the last 2 hours of the original series, like the amount of ground that's covered is remarkable, especially because it sort of gets you out of like the worst recesses of like bad Twin Peaks back to like the last hour of season two being, you know, a masterpiece basically. But I mean, this is a sort of observation that I'm kind of nipping from the Mark Frost book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks. But in that book, a character, I can't remember who, probably Garland Briggs or someone, makes the distinction between mystery and wonder. And mystery is sort of man-made, right? Like a mystery is, you know, who killed the Dowager on the Orient Express, right? Of which Twin Peaks has a lot of that. But the thing that's always sort of elevated it, you know, beyond its pale imitators like the X-Files or something, is that sense of wonder, where there's sort of forces that are transpiring and there's powers beyond the comprehension of men, beyond the comprehension of these characters. And the intimations of those powers and forces can only be felt in these very sort of minor ways. I mean, obviously episode 8, the episode that everyone loves with good reason, is like the grandest statement of that, right? Where you have this whole other realm that's being suggested in a more sort of fulsome way than we've ever seen before in Twin Peaks. So, you know, that said, I would like the mysteries to be resolved and I would like the wonder to be able to sustain itself. And at the end of the day, I have no doubt that it will. I mean, even the end of Fire Walk With Me, that sort of lingering image of Laura and Cooper in the lodge with the angel hovering above them. To me, that was always like such a nice tonal end to this story. This idea that, you know, even if he's trapped there and she's dead and there's all these sort of messed up things going on around them, you know, including like sawmill intrigue and whatnot, that these two sort of like weird broken people have found a kind of solace in another realm. Like I always thought that was just poignant and pretty enough to satisfy me. So, you know, even if the series can end on a subdued grace note like that, I mean, hell, I would still declare it probably the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow. I mean, do we want to maybe give it up for Tom Sizemore right now?
Yeah. And I, you guys were talking about this last week, I think, but Nick, you watched Strange Days recently and...
Yeah, I actually saw it. I saw it the afternoon before episode 11. So yeah, I had a double serving of Sizemore that Sunday.
I've had a similar thing where Sizemore has been popping up. It's like, I know there's a word for this where it's like, as soon as you're aware of a concept, you start seeing that concept more and more. But I was watching something the other night that Sizemore was in.
Was it Dreamcatcher?
I want to say, no, it wasn't Dreamcatcher. I mean, he's obviously in that. This was like a smaller role. Oh, it was Enemy of the State. I was watching Enemy of the State on Friday night, as one does.
Good
and
movie.
Like Sizemore, I've seen. Yes, it's a goodish movie. Sizemore has like an uncredited role in it, but yeah, just like you get this feeling where, and I also watched Strange Days recently, and Sizemore has quite a substantial role in that, but he just keeps popping up more and more, and I think he's terrific in this. Like he said, especially in this past episode, he said so little to do, but this sort of breakdown scene where he starts blubbering and wailing, and what's the line he has? He's like, I want to kill myself or I want to come back. Like he sees no, this sort of fork in the road where he either wants to end his life or redeem himself.
Yeah.
And for a guy who just seemed like kind of a, you know, a klutzy patsy for this whole series, like I thought that was quite moving. And I mean, one of Lynch's great abilities as a filmmaker and artist, I have to qualify artist just to elevate him above fucking Joe Blow filmmakers, is being able, I think, to sort of find this quality in people that other people might not be able to perceive, right? You see it with Jim Belushi, too. It's like you watch this series and you can imagine a whole other career where Jim Belushi was just playing sort of snarling, vaguely menacing heavies in films instead of like dopey best friends or dopier sitcom dads. Yeah, Lynch's ability to sort of find these things in people, I think, is, like, always amazing. Even with, like, David Koechner or Michael Cera in that weird Wally Brando scene. And Sizemore is certainly benefiting the most from this. I mean, you know, you kind of feel like Lynch is gifting Sizemore a second career or something, or a third or fourth.
I kind of sadly think Sizemore probably won't parlay this into anything.
Yeah, I mean, who's to say? who's to say? Of Tom Sizemore's career ambitions, one can only guess. But even, you know, even like it, the sort of development of Dougie, you know, obviously, I think to anyone who's in the show at this point, like, loves Dougie. I know there was some Dougie frustration in early episodes with some fans, especially because you get all those sort of hints that, you know, there's going to be like the Jason Bourne moment where he like becomes Cooper, which again, you have intimations of. But just this way that like, you know, Dougie's sort of touching the dandruff on his back and the way that like this guy's sort of like gentle, naive, unassuming touch can totally like bring Tom Sizemore down, like totally destroy him by seeing how sort of like naive and innocent a human being can be. I mean, one of the more compelling theories I like about the show is, you know, a great filmwriter, Michael Straczynski, wrote a thing. I can't remember where I read it, but he was talking about how The Return basically refers to the gradual return of Cooper, right? And juxtaposing evil Cooper, who is essentially this force of pure malevolence, with all of Aiden Cooper's institutional knowledge, which makes him so deadly and capable, coming against like a reborn Cooper who through Dougie basically has the experience of learning how to be a human being again, learning how to feel like compassion and gentleness and all these sort of things, which I think is a very, I mean, I don't even know if that constitutes a theory, but it's a very compelling reading of what's happening in the show. And I think you see it more and more with not only how Dougie behaves, but how people react to Dougie, like as if he's some sort of magical dolphin or something. So, yeah, I mean, super into it. I'm almost going to be a little disappointed if slash when Cooper comes back.
I posited this theory on Twitter today that the character of Dougie is Lynch and Frost's sly criticism of indie directors being thrust into blockbuster success, even though they have no talent.
like
Colin Trevorrow.
Richard Kelly. There's no way Lynch is commenting on Colin Trevorrow.
I like to think it, John. I like to think
it. It's like that scene in Margaret where they're talking about in the Shakespeare line about how, you know, the gods don't care about the trifles of humans. Like, that's Lynch and Colin Trevorrow.
It's like, it's just on like such another realm of operation that you can't even perceive it.
I was just going to say, I am enjoying also how somehow they're still finding scenarios for Dougie/Cooper to wind up in that feel kind of new. Like how the episode opens with the conga line. And right. If you look at McLaughlin, there is this weird thing where he seems to register, you know, Cooper seems to register the joy of it and the happiness of it. But he's also actively kind of moving in a way that you haven't seen him move before. It was this weird thing where the qualities that he can mimic and that he can emulate are still feeling kind of fresh, something like, what, 10 hours into this character being this way. And also how, yeah, he gets away with sort of, you know, avoiding his own death, strangely. And also, I had joked, you know, speaking of cucks, I had joked that Dougie is kind of an alpha because in the scene when Tom Sizemore is blubbering his confession and he says, you know, I need to apologize to Dougie. And Dougie goes, apologize to Dougie. And he says, I need to thank Dougie. And he goes, thank Dougie. Just the patterns of human behavior that they're still mining from this, I am very impressed by. And I think I'm with you, John. I hope that I kind of hope he never comes back. I really do hope they keep him in that state permanently. And I have seen some fan frustration with it. You know, if you are like myself and you spend a little too much time on the sort of Twin Peaks meme page on Facebook, you'll see people are, you know, sick of it. And I'm like, why? How? You know, it's such a golden opportunity for what they like to do. It's a perfect vehicle for what they like to do and how it will tie up thematically, you know, we'll wait and see.
And it's also nice, like, you know, as someone who greatly admires Lynch's entire canon, to see one of his milieus, which is this ostensibly perfect middle-class all-American family, you know, the Joneses, but instead of it being corrupted by a seed of deceit or evil or something gurgling underneath, sort of the opposite is happening, where like Dougie is sort of elevating their life to a new level of purity. I mean, that scene of Sonny Jim on his like backyard playset with like a tinny version of the song from Swan Lake playing, and for some reason there's a spotlight and he's just like perpetually going through it. I mean, that just ruled. I'm sorry to not be more eloquent or anything about it. But seeing that, it was just like a pure ecstatic expression of joy. Or when you see Naomi Watts's face when like they're delivering all these things, and you know, maybe it's undercut a bit by her loving the money of it or something, but just this idea that like she loves Dougie so much and like she sees him as like somehow being so capable and good, in a way that it's presumed the original Dougie, about which we know next to nothing except that he's only 20 years old or whatever, probably wasn't. If I may say, another one of my favorite moments, if you want to talk about the way the show sort of stymies plot or genre expectation, is the cops getting the fingerprints back and being like, well, it says here, this guy's an ex-FBI agent who also just escaped from a federal penitentiary. And it's like, they have this piece of information that would be so clutch to like any number of other characters in the show, and they just, you know, David Koechner uses it as an excuse to make $2 sinking a free throw, just throwing it in the trash. I mean, that's the kind of stuff where I feel like, I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily like POMO or self-reflexive in this modern way where it's commenting on patterns of viewership. I mean, the show has always sort of been a comment on how cop shows work or how soap operas work, and scenes like that sort of feel like old school Twin Peaks, like Mark Frost being very clever about tweaking the conventions of a cop show.
Yeah, no, I love that moment because that had actually been sort of nestled in the back of my mind, plot development wise. When are we going to get to that? How is that going to blow the whole thing wide open? And then when you get the exterior shot of the Las Vegas Police Department, I thought, okay, here we go. This is going to be the big turning point. You know, we're in the third act now. We're in the last third of this thing, and now everything's going to start to shuffle together, and then, you know, swish. And there's not much implication that will be returned to. Again, who knows, but it just leads into this other little thread about Cooper, Tom Sizemore showing up and paths crossing. So yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out.
And I guess with Sizemore breaking down, I mean, if you want to talk about where the plot might take us, I mean, the presumption was that, you know, Sizemore's character basically had a day to take out Dougie. Obviously, he's not going to do that now unless this sort of come to Jesus moment is part of his long con. But it doesn't seem like it is. So with no one impeding Dougie's journey, I guess we can only wonder how he's going to get to Twin Peaks, or how, you know, Gordon and Albert are going to get to him, or how he's going to essentially, how the plot is going to manage to extricate Dougie Cooper from this sort of metier that he's in, where all he's doing is succeeding, you know? And it is weird. You guys mentioned these sort of Deus Ex Machina moments where, you know, Mike will appear, or there'll be the red flame sort of telling him what to do in certain contexts. But it seems like those are doing nothing in terms of, like, trying to advance him through what the plot might be, or trying to return him to Twin Peaks, or return him to himself. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that the big question mark over my head is, like, how does Dougie fold into all this stuff now that all the sort of impediments and antagonists have kind of been removed and he's free to just be like a kind of oblivious, successful dolt?
Yeah, I would say Patrick Fischler in Las Vegas, that's where he's right, in Las Vegas, on the phone, sort of issuing commands, is kind of the wild card here.
Hey, Mr. Todd, yeah.
Mr. Todd, yeah. But we haven't seen much of him. And the exact nature of his doings remains fairly unclear to me. So yeah, it's very possible we'll get more of him. But how does he get back with 5 hours left? I wonder. It's also funny too, because there are, you know, not to get too much into this kind of speculation, but there are two pieces of footage from previews that we haven't actually seen yet. And I think they're pretty much the last two pieces of footage from the previews, which is, one is Cooper looking much more cognizant in his suit with an FBI pin, which is possibly from an earlier episode, I'm not sure, when he's in the, you know, scary, like, haunted mansion at the start of the third episode. But then there's another one of him driving, which is obviously something that he's not currently in a state to do. So there are little hints as to something cracking at some point, but...
I also noticed that even the sort of stock image on Crave TV, let's get a shout out for at Crave TV, for this episode was Coop or Dougie Coop in the lodge, or at least with a red curtain behind him. And I don't know if, I mean, nothing like that happened in this episode that I can remember. I mean, I watched it twice. Or maybe they just used it from another thing. As much as we all love Dougie, I think we presume that he's going to end up back at Twin Peaks. And it's so weird, though, now. Like, it's been going on for so long, and it's become so pleasant. Like, the idea of him walking to the Double R and being like, does anyone have any coffee and pie? And getting, like, a Bud Bundy, like, canned round of applause. Like, not that that will literally happen, but it feels like that's what people have been, you know, slobbering for the past, like, 15 weeks. And just something about it seems so tacky to me now. I never want Cooper back. Fuck him. He's not even that funny.
Dougie's the alpha.
Damn. Man.
That's true, yeah.
I want to say, people have been bringing this up, I think, almost every week about the show referencing other prestige television programs, but I think it maybe was true this week when it included a nod to the season 2 finale of The OC, the Julie Cooper trying to poison Caleb Nichol for his money, then having a change of conscience scene. So props to Lynch Frost for throwing their nod to that.
Yeah, again, I imagine Lynch and Frost, like the aliens at the end of Men in Black, just like, playing with marbles that have McGee's career in it or something. But yeah, I mean, Ethan, come on, man. It's not like the OC has a monopoly on the idea of someone poisoning someone in fiction.
I will say, because people have also been trying to say that, like, clearly Lynch is a huge Rivette fan or a huge Olivier fan or Pedro Costa fan every week. To me, there's probably a better chance he's seen The OC than at one. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say perhaps it's a reference to DOA, the classic noir remade as Crank.
which I can imagine Lynch enjoying both of. But who knows? I still have this image of him, like, as a guy who doesn't watch movies, just sits around his house. You know the image of Gordon where he's, like, drawing with a magic marker that, like, dog, and he's just drinking nice wine? Like, in my mind, that's what Lynch's life is like. Plus, he's got that, like, sick-ass coffee table he designed that has, like, a cigarette holder in it and all that stuff. But, yeah, I don't know. Have there been other references to premium TV shows? Has there been, like, a...
Well, people are trying to theorize that all the insurance company stuff is a reference to Mad Men. All the Las Vegas stuff is a reference to Breaking Bad in terms of the suburbs. I mean, we know that Lynch has watched those shows, but I think it's kind of reaching, personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's stupid. It's like when people say that something is a 9/11 allegory because something that is vertical gets impacted. It's just like, I don't know, it doesn't hold up. But, right, we're supposed to encourage those things, right? That's supposed to be the fun of TV, is
we need to crank up those think pieces.
Yeah, I don't buy any of that. I mean, I've been very mindful of, like, scanning the show for references to stuff, and, you know, all I can find is stuff that looks like it's from Lynch movies or from Twin Peaks, which is fine. That's how it should be.
Yeah. What did you guys think of some of the... I wonder if we can maybe talk a bit more about the time shuffling stuff, because there is one thing that I thought was odd is how last week the sole appearance from Kyle MacLachlan is him playing, or ostensibly playing catch with Sonny Jim Jones, and he gets the ball thrown at his head, which is kind of clearly established through dialogue that couldn't have happened in the timeline, the ostensible timeline of that episode. And then we get this here. And then we also have Bobby saying that, we found something of my dad's today to Big Ed. But that was what? That was episode 9, and we're on episode 13 mm-hmm. now. Part of me wonders, I mean, it has to be intentional, because that's just a very strange blunder for them to make, potentially. But I wonder how that's... I don't know. Has it colored your perception of the show significantly? We talked about it a little bit before, but I'd like to get into it maybe a bit more heavily.
Well, yeah, and there's also the scene. I mean, this is something I would not have noticed on my own because I'm not that perceptive of a viewer, at least not in this particular way. But when they ask Matthew Lillard's character to, like, date the photograph of Garland Briggs, the date is, like, a week before what the timeline is in Twin Peaks. Where they get the thing and it's like, oh, on 10-1 or 10-2, you have to go to Jackrabbit's Cove or whatever it is. But anyways, I feel like those have totally shifted. And I agree with you, Nick. It's been something that, like, I haven't been able to put my finger on, but it just feels like a lot of scenes are inserted and not out of place. I mean, it's not even, like, particularly avant-garde or something to sort of flatten timelines into one thing where scenes seem to be happening in sync that actually aren't. But I thought about it with this past episode where you see Bobby in the diner again at night, and he says that we found the thing about my dad's today. But there had been a previous scene from a few episodes back, that whole blowout at the diner at night with the woman vomiting, which was presumably before or later. Again, like, it's not like I'm drawing lines trying to keep these things straight. But it is an interesting thing that does call attention to itself, I guess. And you're right. I mean, even the Sonny Jim playing catch, right? Because the presumption is that Dougie gives them the check. They go out to the steakhouse or whatever. They're up all night partying, and then they come in with the conga line. But then somewhere in between or before, presumably before, because the Jungle Jim's not in the backyard, Dougie gets hit in the head with a baseball by Sonny Jim. So... yeah, I don't know. Maybe those are just these sort of, like, interstitial moments that he likes to cut in. Same with Bobby handling the scene of the woman vomiting in the car. It's like, I can't imagine that having any consequence down the line.
Right. You
know, it's just a thing that sort of shows Bobby's capability / his kind of compassion in a scene like that in a way that's more of a character development moment than anything.
Yeah, part of me, it's one of those things, one of many things watching this that I think about in a context that's maybe a bit more down the line, in that I ask myself, how might this play when inevitably we all watch it as an 18-hour thing? You know, when it becomes more piecemeal in that way. Or rather, I suppose, contrarily, less piecemeal because it's one thing, but the flurry of sequences perhaps feels even more unrelenting because it's just jumping from this to this to this to this. Will it be more organic that way? Will it be even more confounding? I'm very curious to see how that might pan out.
Yeah, I mean, Fire Walk With Me does much the same thing in a lot of ways, especially if you, like, fold in this idea of, like, the missing pieces being canon now or something, where, you know, people were sitting down and watching the missing pieces like they're a movie, and it's literally just a disjointed sequence of vignettes that your Blu-ray is playing in arbitrary order. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. As far as watching this as an 18-hour thing, like, who knows how it'll play out in that context, but in certainly in the sort of episodic week-to-week context, you know, I didn't even think about it until this week. That's like, oh, there's Dougie getting hit in the head by Sonny Jim, like, that's kind of cute, boom, on to the next thing. But as far as if those are being reshuffled, I don't know. I mean, maybe. Do they need to be? I don't know.
I mean, the reasoning... Yeah,
they don't necessarily need to be.
The reasoning for it could be, like, thinking of an example this week, if I mentioned the Becky, Shelley phone call, I think, takes place before episode 11. That could be something they just cut in because it was after a mention of Pi, and that scene mentions Pi. It could literally be a chain of, like, sequences that's... The reasoning could be that simple, almost.
Yeah, good point. I mean, like, you're cutting on a sort of, in terms of themes or modes as opposed to temporality, you know? I mean, we, or a TV show, we generally take it to mean meanwhile or later, you know? But there could be, and, you know, there's examples of this in other films of, like, cutting along lines of themes or ideas more than temporality. Which, yeah, I mean, it's something that I feel myself being more interested in the more we talk about it. But yeah, it just kind of rears its head in these, like, kind of rare little moments. But quite compellingly. I mean, again, to come back to the pie scene, I do think that, like, you know, we had that intimation of Dougie loving the pie at that diner or whatever. And then we have this scene that's sort of all about the sort of transfixing power of pie. It makes sense that the scenes are where they are. Just not in a sort of A, B, C, D type sense. I mean, I thought you were going to say, again, to get back to the Men in Black motif, that the camera would pull back and the entire series had, like, unfolded inside of a cherry pie.
Like St. Elsewhere?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The entire series had taken place within an organic, locally sourced cherry that's better than the franchise versions. That would be the ultimate, as Schwarzenegger says in Total Recall, the best mind fucked yet.
Sorry.
I was going to ask, did you guys find yourself looking off at Everett McGill in the shot reverse shot between Norma and her husband or her boyfriend?
Yeah, totally. Because it was one of the things about this is, and I mean, this is just like fanboy horse shit or whatever, but it's, again, it's pleasant, is, you know, Everett McGill, I think the last thing he was in was The Straight Story where he sells Richard Farnsworth a tractor, you know? And again, when, like, they were piecing together production history, it's like Lynch had to, like, drive out to Everett McGill's country house and, like, plead with him to be back in the show. And there is something nice, like, just seeing Everett McGill, Big Ed, however you want to identify him, like, back on screen, and especially in this sort of Twin Peaksian way. I was talking to someone recently about how I always loved the Miami Vice, the TV show, not the much hyped movie, how Don Johnson and his ex-wife always had this, like, very friendly rapport despite the fact that they were divorced. And you kind of get that with, like, Big Ed and Norma in this scene. Like, the relationships have moved on. Or same with Bobby and Shelley, right? Like, people have moved on into other things in their life, but there's still a sort of pleasantness or an unbitterness that transpires between people that I think is very admirable and I think should be more a standard of how people conduct themselves in real life. Sorry, I'm saying moralizing or something. But it's not moralizing, it's actually moral. but I just, like, loved that sort of little scene of, like, this, you know, guy who she's obviously seeing coming in and him quite literally receding to the background. Again, there was a sort of a soupçon of pleasantness to it And it's sort of that same pleasantness that you feel when you read the sort of old reviews of Fire Walk With Me that people sort of hated the movie for not possessing, right? It's like, where are these familiar faces? And before we got to The Return, I used to think those criticisms were total fucking bullshit and they sucked. It's like, who cares? Who cares where James is? Who cares where Big Ed and Dr. Jacoby are? Really? But when you see them, it is nice to see them. And I can't explain that beyond any sort of thing, beyond just having a sort of nice, nostalgic, pleasant relationship with a TV show or a pop culture artifact that you've enjoyed. Sorry if that was a spiel.
Oh, no. Oh,
and no, I think that's an appropriate episode for it.
And I just double checked, and apparently Everett McGill's last on screen appearance was an episode of JAG.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In 1999. Show. Yeah.
Wow. Was it a straight story too? Oh, whatever. I don't want to.
Same year. I'd love to talk about it. I'd love to do an Everett McGill episode, talk about Iguana, Under Siege 2.
Iguana! Ethan, you favorited my Iguana tweet where I was just trying to piggyback off Twin Peaks last night to throw some love for Monty Hellman's Iguana, starring Everett McGill, as basically not to cross streams in terms of premium cable, but a man with grayscale living on an island. Good actor, interesting face. The kind of people you never see, like you would never see a new actor who looks like Everett McGill, I feel. Mm.
And what a great close-up the episode ends with.
Oh, totally. And like I say, I kind of maybe came out a bit contemptuous of it off the top, saying that it's only a sort of answer to, where are these people while they're eating soup? But it is, again, it's just nice to see this guy in his element and the sort of quietude of his life. And I think it's the only time we sort of got a role credits over a character. I mean, I know there was the guy playing piano two episodes ago. But the credits just rolling over a character kind of doing nothing. And, you know, obviously burning the matchbook has natural Twin Peaksy implications, but I don't think it means anything. I just think it's a bored guy burning out some matches.
I think people did point out that his reflection in the window looks different from how he is sitting down. I don't know. It's curious.
Ooh.
But I won't get into it.
John, really, an instance of that is like where I agree with John's initial piece from months ago. Please don't theorize stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just saying, people brought it up, you know? Just
all right. It is fun to watch this stuff. And actually, I learned after writing that thing, a lot of people brought it to my attention that Lynch himself becomes very obsessed with these groups and these forums and stuff, or at least did back in the day. Like, he was very interested to see the sort of depths that people would take it to. But yeah, I don't know, to me, and it's hard to talk about this stuff without like lapsing into cliche about, you know, art house cinema or something like that, but I think that there's just a lot more pleasure in sort of accepting that you don't know where it's going and being surprised by it, being compelled by it, being intermittently bored or frustrated by it. I don't know, I personally just enjoy kind of riding those waves, as opposed to, although I do it from time to time, like combing Reddit or YouTube to try to find satisfactory answers that will only be obviated by the next week when the new episode airs. But it's interesting to see how much of that this show still invites. And it's no surprise. I mean, to me personally, the first time I became aware of this whole sort of online culture of like fan speculation was when I saw Mulholland Drive in like 9th grade or 10th grade. And just literally being like, what is going on? And just being on like, you know, page 780 of the Rotten Tomatoes forums.
Oh, may they rest in peace. I remember those.
Where is Aunt Ruth? Maybe she's being carried out of the apartment in a suitcase. And, you know, there is a sort of a fun detective work to that. But I feel like when people do that, it always kind of forgets that Lynch's work has a way of sort of upsetting that sort of logic, you know? Or maybe you can do both simultaneously. Maybe you can have fun following the clues or doing the guesswork and not actually expecting it to have a bearing on how the show is going to unfold.
Well, on that note, any closing thoughts?
No, I love Twin Peaks The Return. A lot of people think I'm a hater who doesn't like stuff. But Twin Peaks The Return, if I may say, the first night it aired, I came home to my apartment
and I brought home a fucking cherry pie, and not some bullshit Loblaws cherry pie, like a proper bakery fucking $25 cherry pie. And I went to 6 different stores to find like coffee or cappuccino flavored ice cream to serve it with. And I served it up. I was beside myself for no audience. I wasn't in a viewing party or anything like that. Just me and one other person. So, you know, I think that there's something about this show that invites that sort of level of unself-conscious, embarrassing fanaticism. And it's good to see it actually be rewarded instead of just let down. Because I was so ready to be let down by this series. And week after week, it just sort of burrows into my heart more and more.
That's a great way to put it. Where can we find you again? You mentioned it at the top of the show, but where can we find you on the internet, John?
So you can read my writing in Maclean's, the Globe and Mail, Salon, and on Twitter at JohnSemley3000, tweeting absolute garbage all the time.
Nick, where can we find you?
As always, you can find me at twitter.com/Nick_Newman. You can find me on thefilmstage.com, and you can see, experience, feel my real world doings with Grasshopper Film.
Well, you can find me on twitter.com/EthanVess, and I also have a doppelganger Twitter account out there, but I will not bring it up. It's truly more evil than Alpha Coop himself. But thank you both, and we'll see you next week. Just you.